Because if they go out, because if they are going abroad to study, they have to learn this language in order to communicate in a much better way.
Yeah, there has to be one international language, like to communicate with others, like with different communities. So, you know, you have an own language.
I'm just going to make this clear. I'm not saying don't have a second language. Yes. Don't preserve your own language. But the concept of an international language is that there are no arguments and issues caused between two different cultures that probably don't understand one another. Mm-hmm. That one common language is what's keeping the ties together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? To portray one culture to another. I'm not saying, oh, look, because we have this one international language, there's no need for any other language. Now just know this one language. Obviously, now, preserving languages is also a big deal.
Yes, it's a very important thing to preserve. I told you, in linguistics, it's a very important fact to keep mm-hmm. your languages wherever you are, a small village or in a big country. Mm-hmm. Now, we said that superpowers occupied many lands. That's why their language prevailed everywhere. Language that we're studying based on the mother country that is giving us that language, that country has to be superpower, because the more you have to use their, I don't know, applications, since we are living in a modern world, you use their applications, therefore you have to learn their languages. You read their books, their history, their whatever, you have to know their language. Also, those languages have some perhaps easier structure, easier way to pick up, to get along with them. Mm-hmm. And also, we talked about the possibility of this international language to change. And we said, why not? Probably many things would happen in the future.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Ironically, the concept of the Mother Tongue Day came from a country that was split up into two parts, that had different cultures. And the concept of conserving and keeping that culture alive and that language alive mm-hmm. was really what brought up this concept of having a Mother Tongue Day, mm-hmm. of really recognizing all the different languages that there are in the world and giving them some significance that, look, there are other languages other than this one language that's used yes. by the majority of the world, right? To show the importance of keeping that mother tongue, in a sense, that language, that original language amongst the youth even today.
You know what's very interesting to note about international language? Wherever you go to institutes and you want to learn some new languages, the things they teach you in their books is not just the language. You learn their culture as well. Yeah. They would impose you with the thoughts and ideas they have, you know? Because, for example, many people did not know about some specific rituals in some countries.
You know, many speakers, like English speakers, they try to opt the Western culture.
Exactly.
Because, you know, English is basically what comes in our mind is like Western culture, Western society.
Exactly.
So that's what happened, you know? And, you know, Western culture, it's got like good and the bad mm-hmm. sides of it. So,
and also advertisement tells a lot in the story of international language. When we, I told you, I open up a page in the net mm-hmm. and then I have to learn English language. So that's the point. Advertisement also works a lot. All the applications I use, I have to know English. Propagandas, the plans that are being done behind the scenes mm-hmm. for a language to become the international language.
Yeah.
You are forced in order to learn that language.
Exactly. That's
There's
what I
no
say.
You don't... idea. Living in this world right now in modern days, you have to know English. You know what I mean?
Yeah, as I've said, you know,
for travel, for work, for everything, you have to know English.
That's what, right? You know, as I said, like, you know, world language today is considered to be English. But that's the other thing, you know, it's been made like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes, it's been made like that.
It's been pushed in that direction.
Yeah, in that direction, yeah. Because they wanted their language to be, you know, the ruling language. Yeah. The ruling language.
Keep your languages wherever you are and preserve your cultures, because it is your heritage. That's whatever you have. Thank you for listening to us. It was a very nice and amazing time to be with you. and with you, two very dear guests. Thank you for sharing with us a boundless amount of information. Until another session of Factor Reality, I bid you farewell and I leave you to the protection of Allah. Thank you for listening to us.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi. Let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi. Let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
On World Water Day, water pollution has reached an alarming level in the besieged Gaza Strip. The enclave's coastal aquifer is almost completely polluted with various contaminants. The groundwater in Gaza has high levels of nitrates and other dangerous pollutants, with contamination levels 3 times higher than international standards for safe drinking water. The Israeli regime has imposed tight restrictions on the entry of badly needed equipment to maintain water and sewer systems and targeted them during wars.
Today, about 98% of our municipal water wells, drinking water wells, their water quality does not fit with the WHO standards related to the drinking water standards.
In recent years, Gaza municipalities were forced to pump untreated raw sewage directly into the sea due to lack of electricity for treatment plants. Raw sewage seepage into the ground has worsened the water crisis. Palestinian officials say Israel has for years deprived residents of Gaza of healthy water supply and stolen their underground resources.
Israel tried to steal our groundwater by having their pumping wells along the eastern border of Gaza Strip and preventing the flow of groundwater by gravity, by lowering the water table and reverse the direction of the groundwater at that location.
The Israeli blockade and wars have taken their toll on Gaza's water infrastructure. Experts say the tiny seaside sliver is currently in a chronic state of water emergency.
Gaza is suffering due to the water catastrophe with full meaning. Shortage of water, at the same time we have polluted water. We are calling on the international community in order to end this blockade, which is one of the main reasons for such catastrophe that we are living in.
According to human rights organizations, depriving people of water supplies is a clear breach of international law.
On World Water Day, experts say that the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade is the first step towards easing the water crisis in the coastal enclave. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Amid the ongoing fuel crisis in Yemen, the Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference in front of the United Nations office in Yemen's capital Sana'a to shed further light on the catastrophic consequences of Saudi Arabia's illegal seizure of Yemen's oil ships.
The intensification of the siege and the attempt to harm the public service sectors, especially the health sector, which needs electricity permanently, will cause more civilians, including women and children, to be killed. We believe that the United Nations is seeking to prolong the war to benefit from the donor country's funds, and also because it grants fuel ships transit permits and then provides political cover-up for the piracy acts carried out by the Saudi-led coalition.
Ministry of Human Rights says the fuel crisis has impacted all aspects of life in the war-torn country, including healthcare services, transportation, and public services.
We held this press conference in the presence of many service sector officials to send a message to the world that those who pay lip service to human rights are themselves besieging the Yemeni people. The humanitarian situation today continues to deteriorate, and the Saudi blockade has affected all aspects of life, including the health sector, transportation, and public services. The international community must take serious steps to end the Saudi war in Yemen as they seek to end the Russian-Ukrainian conflict.
Recently, Saudi Arabia has been tightening the blockade it has imposed on Yemen and has prevented the entry of fuel ships to Hodeidah port despite obtaining UN permits. This has led Yemen to the worst fuel crisis since the beginning of the war on March 2015.
People here say the Yemeni army's recent retaliatory attacks against Saudi Arabia's vital facilities are a normal reaction to Riyadh's illegal measures against Yemen's fuel imports. They believe that the Yemeni army will eventually break the Saudi siege as Riyadh only understands the language of force. Abdulatif Roshali, Sana.
Since late last week, France has seen nationwide anti-government protests almost every day. March 17th's protests were over better pay and working conditions. March 19th saw the yellow vests and protests against state-sponsored Islamophobia and racism. While March 21st saw the record price of gasoline cause taxi drivers, truckers, fishermen, and others to protest nationwide. President Emmanuel Macron has joined the European Union's unprecedented sanction drive against top energy supplier Russia for its military operation in Ukraine, regardless of the economic costs on the average French household. The price of petrol has crossed the psychological barrier of 2 euros per liter, creating inflation in goods across the board. Those on low and fixed incomes are now being told to make sacrifices by politicians who may be living far more comfortable lifestyles.
Moi, je pense qu'ils souffrent vraiment.
I think that people are really suffering. Unfortunately, this doesn't mean much to our leaders. There are elderly people who live off canned sardines, if not canned cat food. French politics is 30 years behind where it should be. And if it doesn't change, there might be a civil war here.
Adding to the hardships being asked of the average French voter, Macron recently announced that if re-elected, he will raise the retirement age to 65. That has caused the left-wing candidate, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, to jump in the first-round polls to third place, but he still trails the far-right's Marine Le Pen by several points.
They aren't even talking about inflation in the election campaign. For everyone in France, it's big news, but not to our candidates. Everyone who isn't rich is wondering if the energy price increases are ever going to stop, while the poor wonder if they are ever going to be targeted by government aid.
While inflation has soared, it's not like this is a new problem for the average French person. Despite long-time official claims of low inflation, reduced purchasing power has been the number one issue for voters in 2017 and 2012 as well. There will be at least two more days of nationwide protests this week. France's first-round presidential vote is now less than 3 weeks away. Many are saying that the final days of Macron's five-year term are ending in a typical fashion, full of anti-government protests. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
To many, poverty in England is a figment of the imagination. But with the living costs climbing up every day, just getting by is becoming more of a struggle than ever. And not just for the vulnerable.
When we go out just to do shopping for the kids, if I see like 5 years, 10 years back, £100 worth it to spend, you can buy a lot of things. But if I go today with £100 and to buy grocery for my home or kids, I mean, I cannot even fill the basket.
Announcing a phase-out of Russian oil imports earlier this month, Prime Minister Boris Johnson spoke of dark days ahead, but those days seem to be here already. Charities such as Step Change are calling on the government to increase welfare benefits and offer more help with skyrocketing energy bills. There are families who can only turn on their heating for 2 hours a day and use torches at night rather than spending on electric light. The answer from the government has left a lot to be desired. Chancellor Rishi Sunak says he cannot fully protect people from the consequences of rising prices.
There are lots of different ways he could try and play this. What he shouldn't be doing is just tinkering with, say, a little bit off the petrol or a little bit off the gas price. That won't make much difference. Focus on the weakest in society, paid for by those with the strongest in society. Those with the broadest shoulders bear the greatest weight.
To try to curb the soaring cost of living, the Bank of England has upped interest rates. But it's a fine balance.
Landlords will soon pass on the increases. Rising interest rates affects everybody, including renters. But not everybody is affected equally. Because when you're spending every last cent on housing, food and fuel, what's there to cut when the prices keep going up?
It means more people pushed into poverty. 2.5 million people in the United Kingdom used a food bank in the past year. A former prime minister has called the crisis the worst he has ever seen.
You're going to see, I'm afraid, a significant rise in the cost of living for Britons over the next 2 years. It's not just the current level of basic items, such as the cost of fuel, the general sort of power for utilities and things like that, but also the basic cost of food. Now, that's today. The bit I worry about is actually what's going to happen in 6 months, a year's time.
It's a time of ordinary people trying to deal with extraordinary price hikes, with very little in the way of respite on the horizon. Saeed Puriza, London.
At present, the 27 nations in the European Union spend 1.5% of their economic output on weapons and troops. That is about to increase significantly because EU ministers meeting in Brussels have just adopted their strategic compass following 2 years of negotiations.
Today, the military expenditure in Europe of all member states adding up, it's about 200,000 million euros. We have to spend more.
In his press conference, Borrell highlighted that combined EU nations already spend four times more than Russia on military capabilities, but that is still not enough, he said. He insists the bloc's military plan will not undermine NATO. Many analysts say there's no doubt that it will, but that's not a bad thing, as NATO is driven by an aggressive US foreign policy, they suggest. Foreign and defence ministers are in the process of creating an EU army. They say the conflict in Ukraine proves the importance of such a move. When opinion polls are carried out, most citizens always agree they don't want more money being spent on war machines.
The more we put focus energy on something wrong like war, you know, it increases the chance that war is coming to us.
I just think it's to make the people feel safe, but I don't really think it will change anything, so I think they should spend money on something different.
There is also resistance to the huge amounts of money being spent by the 30 countries that make up the NATO military alliance.
My party and my political friends, we want that Germany goes out of NATO. We want to bring Russia into Europe because Russia is a part of Europe and the United States are far from Europe.
NATO and EU leaders will hold summits later this week here in the Belgian capital. Peace activists are calling for greater diplomatic efforts by them to end the bloodshed in Ukraine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
As the spring season begins in Kashmir, the earth turns lush green and the trees bear colourful blossoms, with the sky visibly blue and waters clear and glassy. After a not-so-harsh winter this year, the people of Kashmir are welcoming the onset of spring. Nowruz, or the Persian New Year, marks the beginning of spring and is celebrated on March 21st. New trees are planted while people offer prayers and seek God's help for a prosperous year.
Each year we await this season so that we can plant new trees. The process of their growth gives us hope, and that hope teaches us that God has set a time for everything. We can't fast-track it. We can only do our best efforts.
On the occasion of Nowruz, women in Kashmir prepare unique dishes made from lotus stem and fish. Mehra and her sister have a busy day today. Friends and family are invited to relish the moment.
We have been taught by our mothers and grandmothers to cook these delicacies on the special occasion of Nowruz.
It requires lots of dedication, and what matters is that this food brings friends and families together, and a lot of positive energy is exchanged. For us, Nowruz is not just an occasion, but it marks a fresh beginning of love, growth and prosperity.
On the occasion of Nowruz, the Kashmiri administration often organizes musical festivals to add fervor to the celebrations. People, especially children, visit these musical festivals in large numbers so that the year starts with cheerful memories. This year, scores of tourists have also come to witness Kashmir's spring.
We had heard that Kashmir looks magical, but we witnessed in reality that this land looks fabulous, especially the spring season.
The early arrival of tourists has added a lot of positivity to Kashmir's tourism sector, which has been hit hard by years of political instability and turmoil. Persian culture is deeply rooted in Kashmir, and celebrating Nowruz is a sign of its influence.
Nowruz marks a new beginning, and after suffering decades of political instability and 2 years of the COVID pandemic, people are only hoping for a return back to a normal life and an everlasting peace. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
The Iranians are celebrating it as an ancient festivity marking the first day of spring and the renewal of nature. Nowruz, a legacy from thousands of years ago, always energizes people celebrating the event to observe many customs.
Nowruz promotes values of peace and solidarity within families and across generations. It is believed to be a key contributor to cultural diversity and friendship among different communities.
Days before the arrival of Nowruz, Iranians hastily do backlogs and go shopping to embrace the turn of the Persian year, with a lot of ceremonial customs waiting to be observed. Iranians get prepared for Nowruz by cleaning their house, a custom known as Khana Tekani. Dusting and cleaning home appliances and furniture, washing rugs and etc. are just parts of the house cleaning process. Moreover, the Nowruz festivity has a symbolic item unique to this tradition, Sofreya Haftsin. The Haftsin spread includes 7 items, all starting with the letter Sin in the Persian alphabet. Iranians say there is a history behind each element, including serke, or vinegar, symbolizes patience and immortality, somek is a symbol of love and compassion, sib, or apple, is said to represent health and fertility, senjad, or silver berry, is seen as a simulator of love and affection, sabze, or sprout, symbolizes rebirth, sear, or garlic, is a symbol of protection in the face of affliction, and samanu represents affluence.
Iranians spend the night of Nowruz with their family. The traditional New Year dinner is fish with rice and herbs. Many families give a money gift called AD to the children to mark the New Year. People often visit each other's homes and always bring traditional gifts.
Nowruz provides a good opportunity for families and relatives to get together and visit each other. That is why Nowruz has been regarded as the feast of unification. The celebration of Nowruz needs a happy ending to make it perfect. So on the last day of this celebration, people go outdoors to celebrate the end of the Nowruz holidays. The last day of Nowruz holidays is called Sizdabedar, or 13 Day Out, which is also called Nature's Day.
Nowruz is a time for family and friends to gather and celebrate the end of 1 year and the beginning of the next. Preparing for Nowruz starts a few weeks before the new year with the traditional spring cleaning of the home. At this time, it is also customary to purchase new clothing and new furniture for the home.
In 2009, the United Nations proclaimed Nowruz as an international event at the initiative of several countries that share this event, including Iran, Afghanistan, India, and Turkey. It is now widely known to be a symbol of peace to many people.
Nowruz is reminiscent of renewal and a new life. It's something beyond a mere festival. It's a culture which introduces a human civilization. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Refugees are welcome here, the most popular chant at today's protest. Thousands gathered outside the BBC over the weekend, disappointed yet again by the way Western governments are treating people fleeing war and persecution.
People here today say that the British population is being brainwashed by a racist state-funded media. That's probably why today's protest is being held outside the BBC. They want to know why Ukrainian refugees are being welcomed, but refugees from almost anywhere else will soon be branded criminals.
The UK has issued 4,000 visas for Ukrainians with family in Britain, and anyone with a spare room is being offered £350 a month to house those without family here. They can stay for 3 years, they can work, and will have access to public services, including the National Health Service. Meanwhile, the government is pushing through the controversial Nationality and Borders Bill that could see refugees from elsewhere arriving via routes like the English Channel get up to 4 years in prison.
I feel like we're forgetting that other people are still fighting to be like considered as worthy of empathy. And we need to keep thinking about people in Palestine, in Yemen, and, you know, all the previous refugees that came to the UK, for instance, that were not treated as well, like the Syrian refugees. And for me, I think this is what today is about, to remember that we're all humans and we all deserve to be treated the same way.
Protests like these attract people campaigning for various causes, all of them somehow related to the persecution of minorities and racism.
I've been a supporter of Stand Up to Racism for many years. I grew up in apartheid South Africa and left the country because of the apartheid situation and came to England and did my education here. And I am very sympathetic to refugees. I'm appalled that we don't have, as a formerly Christian country in this country, a more open and welcoming view on refugees.
We are not against anti-Semitism. We are against the violent action of being to our kids in Gaza, and we are totally supporting Jewish people, and we are totally supporting anyone who is decent to others and peaceful to others.
Before hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian refugees mobilized, the UK insisted its public services are at breaking point. Tabloid newspapers encouraged millions to vote for Brexit in 2016, creating the illusion that Britain was being overrun by foreigners. But the media is now sending a very different message. It seems the NHS can cope, and Ukrainian refugees will not be taking any British jobs. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Congratulations to all at the arrival of a spring and revival of nature.
In the limelight. 2021 has been marked by a remarkable level of petulance in the UK-EU relationship. The unfortunate reality is that 2022 doesn't offer much hope of redemption. We now present you an article written jointly by Daniel Buffy, Philip Inman and James Tapper. The piece is titled UK and the EU Set to Remain Best of Enemies as 2022 Dawns. Please stay with us for more. When Ursula von der Leyen, the European Commission President, gave her lengthy State of the Union speech last September, there were mentions aplenty of the European Union's vital relationships with Turkey, the Western Balkans and Africa. Von der Leyen, a former student at the London School of Economics, explained the continent's security and economic prosperity depended on nurturing and deepening ties with its neighbourhood. Britain did not register in the hour-long speech. Not a word was said of the United Kingdom, the recently exited EU member state and the sixth largest world economy. Now read back Liz Truss's admittedly short back catalogue of speeches as Foreign Secretary. A visitor from Mars might assume that the United Kingdom is an Indo-Pacific power. Europe barely gets a mention, and if it does it, it is described in terms of being historical baggage. 2021 has been marked by a remarkable level of petulance in the UK-EU relationship. The unfortunate reality is that 2022 doesn't offer much hope of redemption. France will hold the rolling presidency of the European Union for the first 6 months, during which Emmanuel Macron will have an election campaign to fight and win against the centre and far right. Boris Johnson is on his uppers, with a large and vocal wing of the Conservative Party frothing over COVID restrictions and a lack of Brexit dividend. The UK did not want to include a foreign and security cooperation aspect to the Brexit deal it signed last Christmas Eve. After almost 5 years of being lectured at, and with the bloc being far from nimble in this area, this was perhaps understandable. The UK government instead sought to focus on bilateral relations, particularly with France, with whom it has close military ties, through the 2010 Lancaster House treaties. But the lesson of this year must surely be that relations with France, or indeed Germany, cannot be dealt with in isolation from the wider relationship with the European Union. Downing Street has been seeking a summit between Boris Johnson and Emmanuel Macron for months, where it had hoped to build on past agreements, but has been stonewalled by the Elysee Palace, irritated by the British approach to its treaties with the European Union and its constant bad-mouthing of the project, whether over the vaccine rollout or the challenges of illegal migration. New German Chancellor Olaf Scholz attended his first EU summit just recently, but it is yet to be seen whether a date with the British Prime Minister is even in the diary. Britain might not want to be part of the European Union, but the European Union exists. Ignoring one another might be an option, but it isn't a smart one. Britain's economy heads into the new year weighed down by a decline in trade and falling business and consumer confidence. Exports were 14% below their 2018 average level in the third quarter of 2021. And there are many economists who doubt sales of UK products abroad will return to 2018 levels until 2024. Britain's car manufacturing output declined by more than a quarter in November as the combined shocks of Brexit and the after effects of the Delta variant forced factory owners, struggling with job vacancies and component shortages, to cut production. December, marred as it is by the Omicron variant, is not expected to provide a lift to an industry that exports 80% of what it makes. Samuel Toombs, chief UK economist at the consultancy Pantheon Macroeconomics, says, "Exporters have lost market share due to the woefully inadequate EU trade deal," adding, "the uncertainty over trade relationships with the European Union and other countries will continue to deter firms from making Britain their export base. On the domestic front, high street sales have failed to hit their usual Christmas peaks, and most events, indoor and outdoor, have reported declining visitors." Bank of England, worried about the effect of inflation, became the first major central bank to raise interest rates since the pandemic started, when it increased the base rate earlier this month. While the 0.15 percentage point nudge to 0.25% is unlikely to tip any businesses or households into bankruptcy, it came at a time when official figures showed levels of corporate insolvencies already hitting pre-pandemic levels. Insolvency experts have predicted a threefold increase in bankruptcies across the United Kingdom in 2022, and probably more if interest rates rise by more than the expected 0.5 percentage points by December of next year. The Bank of England's gross domestic product growth forecast of 5% next year is beginning to look vulnerable to a downgrade, especially if the government fails to restrict the spread of the Omicron variant and consumer confidence falls further. The Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, has avoided providing a further stimulus to the economy after the closure of the furlough scheme after warnings about a rise in unemployment proved unfounded, notwithstanding a £1 billion boost for the hospitality and leisure industries to support them during the crisis. However, it has become clear that high levels of inflation will be sustained well into 2022, damaging households' real disposable income and putting pressure on the Chancellor to provide more support, especially for low-income families. In April, disposable incomes will probably be hit again by a near 40% to 50% rise in Ofgem's energy price cap, which will push average inflation above 6%. At a deeper level, the Office for National Statistics, the ONS, revised data for business investment recently. It showed the money spent upgrading plant machinery and IT fell by 2.5% in the third quarter to leave private sector investment 11.7% below that seen in the fourth quarter of 2019. Taking note of the collapse in funds devoted to capital spending, the Office for Budget Responsibility, the Treasury's independent forecaster, said it could be partly laid at the door of Brexit, which had cost the UK 4% of its gross domestic product or GDP, that is around £80 billion. If any areas were to see the sunlit uplands of Brexit, the most likely were surely farming and fishing. Leave campaigners have claimed those two industries were being hamstrung by European Union rules, which government ministers could not change. Yet both have taken serious hits since last January, and there is deep anger and a sense of betrayal. Fishing is governed by international quota agreements to prevent fish stocks being destroyed by overfishing. Quotas are negotiated each December by Norway, Iceland, the Faroe Islands, Greenland, and the European Union. And in 2016, the Fisheries Minister, George Eustace, said British fishing was being harmed because the UK was denied a seat at the table. According to Jane Sandell, the chief executive of UK Fisheries, which owns Britain's largest trawler, the Kirkella, when UK officials took up the seat in December of last year, they failed. She said there was no deal with Norway. They just gave up. They decided there wasn't a deal to be done. Recently, the UK did reach a deal with Norway and the European Union. Jane Sandell said, "They've done a deal, but it's not a good deal. The Arctic cod quota is a derisory amount. We would normally have about 10,000 tonnes, but there's 500. The government said UK vessels could catch 7,000 tonnes of Arctic cod, an increase of 1,500 on last year, a statement Jane Sandell said was misleading because it was half the normal amount. She said, "We're operating at 50% of capacity next year. In the new year, We're going to have to sit down and seriously think about the way ahead. The Kerkela may be moved abroad. Not all crew are worse off, though. Those catching mackerel and other pelagic fish have seen an increase in the amount they can catch. But according to the National Federation of Fishermen's Organisations, overall the fishing fleet will be £300 million worse off by 2026. According to the National Federation of Fishermen's Organisations Chief Executive, Barry Dees, at the start of the year, many vessels had been unable to land catches in European ports due to new export rules, but those issues had been resolved. The deal signed with the European Union meant that UK fishermen could only catch 12,000 tons of non-quota fish in European waters, while their counterparts could take 40,000 tons. He said it really reflects the imbalance that was in the common fisheries policy. Farmers are less directly involved in European Union trade, but there is clear discontent about the outcome of Brexit. Farming is a significant part of the North Shropshire constituency, a Leave-dominated area that swung dramatically to the Liberal Democrats in the by-election earlier this month. The National Farmers Union said that total agri-food exports so far this year were down by 16% compared to 2019. Although the pandemic created trade problems, exports to the EU were down by 22% to £7.2 billion, but only by 2% in the rest of the world to £4 billion.
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, توحید کلمه برای کلمه توحید. In English, it means uniting words for the sake of the word of unity.
I think one of the great things that he did was to be ambassador of Ayatollah Burujerdi in order to extend the gratitude to Sheikh Shaltut for acknowledging Shia as one of the official Islamic sect.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
What will we say in front of it? Mu'allim.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to The Teacher, an analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia dignitaries and scholars all across the world of Islam. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh Mahdavi, and welcome to your show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Today we want to talk about an outstanding figure who has spent most of his life in preaching the Shia Islam. Also, he attempted very much in order to achieve Islamic proximity between different denominations and Islamic unity. He is no one but Mirza Khalil Qamarani. Okay, Sheikh Mahdavi, let's start with you, brother Mirza Khalil Qamarani. What information do we have about his early life?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ayatollah Haj Mirza Khalil Qamarani, born in 1892 in Fernagh, one of the rural areas of the city of Khomein, which is also known as Kamara. He was an author, researcher, philosopher of contemporary theology, and he had many social activities and also cultural activities. Since this great and outstanding scholar might be unknown and unfamous to our dear listener, I think this is a good idea to get to know about this personality through his teachers and also his contemporary outstanding scholars and the students.
Yes.
So as for the teacher, we can count great and outstanding scholar Sheikh Abdul Kalim Ha'iri Yazdi, the founder of the Seminary School of Qom, as one of his teacher. Besides him, we see the name of Mirza Jawad Aghai Malikiye Tabrizi, who is the great teacher of the Akhlaq.
Yes.
Who's the author of the book Al-Muraqabat. Maybe most of our audience, yes, they're familiar with this book. And Sheikh Abbas Qummi, also he benefited from the presence of this great scholar, who is the author of the most famous book among Shias, which is Mafatihul Jannah.
That's right.
Regarding his classmates and those with whom he was participating in the classes and he was taking part in discussions and mubahathat, al-hawzaviyya. This is the specific type of learning in Hawza, which is called the mubahatha.
Yes.
Students of the seminary sitting around each other and go over and discuss about whatever they learned in the class. So one of his partner in the discussion or mubahatha was Imam Khomeini, who was the leader of the Islamic revolution of Iran. As I said, through these personalities, we can get to know how great this man was. Yes. And when it comes to the students, we see the name of Sayyid Murtaza Askari. And this is a well-known figure that we had some programs for him in our, yes, program. Ayatollah Taliqani, who was the very famous activist in social and political areas before the revolution and also after the revolution of Iran. So he was a very great man who got to the level of ijtihad and get the permission of ijtihad.
That's right.
From his teacher. And he had a very broad activity.
Yes.
I mean, from the Hawzavi and seminary scholarly type of the activity you can see in his biography, up to the cultural, social,
right,
having relationship with the great scholars of other religions and countries all around the world.
That's right.
So I think we have to take our time talking about his personality more and more, inshallah, right, later on.
I think Sheikh Ziyaniya, most of his life was dedicated into establishing a kind of dialogue between the Muslims based on, we can say, the common grounds, especially between the Shiites and the Sunnis. And we know that he was the special representative or deputy of Ayatollah Burujerdi in order to go to Egypt and thank Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut, who believed, in the Ja'fariya school of thought as one of the official schools of thought among the Muslims. Let's talk a little bit about this aspect of the life of Mirza Khalil Qamari.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baray kalame tuhid."
Very good.
That in English it means uniting words for the sake of the word of unity.
Very good.
So he was believing in this idea that we have to unite all the words from all over the world to get around a table under the name of unity, tawheed.
Yes.
That God is one.
Okay.
So this is also exactly according to the verses of the Quran. قُلْ يَا أَهْلَ الْكِتَابِ تَعَالَوْا إِلَىٰ كَلِمَةٍ سَوَاءٍ بَيْنَنَا وَبَيْنَكُمْ أَلَّا نَعْبُدَ إِلَّا اللَّهِ. The first phase that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Holy Quran puts emphasis on this also is tawheed, that he is calling non-Muslims also to sit around this table.
Okay.
Yet Muslims should sit there for
you
sure.
You mean establishing wahda based on tawheed?
Yes.
Okay.
This is the milestone of the mindset of, yes, Sheikh Khalil Qamari.
Okay.
And to establish this, you know, understanding amongst Muslims, he tolerated and suffered from very different problems and, you know, issues. So that's why he is trying to write some books regarding this wahdat. And he put emphasis on the invitation of Islam to say that, okay, let's gather around this invitation. And he highlights four pillars for this invitation. First of all, the establisher of the invitation, that is the Holy Prophet, and the book of invitation, that is Quran, and the place toward which we are invited, that is Mecca, Baytullah al-Haram, and toward the leaders of invitation, that are A'imma and the pious people who are the from the generation of the Holy Prophet.
So the Holy Prophet, the Holy Quran, Kaaba, and the A'imma.
Yes.
A'immat al-Masumin.
So these four pillars are the main pillars that if we rely on them, mm-hmm, and we put emphasis on them, we may gather around them and we would forget about the differences that we may have with other people.
Very good.
And I should also highlight this point that because he was familiar with the history of Islam, that's why he tried to highlight the points in history of Islam to mention that when, for example, Muslims are united at this era, they have got these benefits. And if they have forgotten about the unity, these are the problems that they may face with. Beside all these issues, we should notice that he put emphasis on Qibla. And he says that Qibla is the manifestation of Islamic rules.
That's right.
Is an injunction according which Muslims may manifest and may exhibit what they believe in.
Okay.
So he gives examples. For example, he says Muslims must stand toward Qibla when they want to say prayer.
Yes.
Or it's, for example, recommended to sleep toward Qibla, or even when you want to pray, it's better to stand toward Qibla. And if they want to perform Hajj, they have to go to the Baytullah al-Haram and circulate around that, you know, place, that house. And he says, because this Kaaba is the manifestation of the glory of Islam.
That's right.
So if we want to get united, we should get united around this, you know, house. And even because at that time, there was no, you know, Muslim government that was, you know, in that position to be the head of Muslim Ummah. Even Sheikh Khalil Kamari wrote a letter to the King of Saudi Arabia to be at this position and let Muslim people around Baytullah al-Haram, and even the King of Saudi Arabia be the head of this Muslim Ummah to let them sit beside each other.
You mean Malik Faisal?
Yes.
That's right.
But he wrote also, he was not successful in this regard.
He wrote also so many letters to the kings and the leaders of the Muslim Ummah, and we can say informing them about his concern regarding the Islamic Wahda and the unity among the Muslims, you know, and we can say avoiding segregational and segregationist look in the religion of Islam.
And it's also important to know that even once a letter came from Vatican, from Pope's side, to ask some questions regarding Islamic beliefs in 12 different questions. And this letter was sent to Sheikh Khalil Kamari because he was very active regarding sending letters to different figures all around the world. Even he sent a letter to Richard Nixon, the president of the United States, to say that, triumphing over the moon is not important if you have not conquered the hearts of people.
Yes.
So if you have conquered moon,
yes,
so let's conquer the hearts of Muslims that they are living in Middle East or different countries and they are deprived from their rights.
That's all right. Okay. Thank you very much. Really fruitful life he had, Mirza Khalil Kamari. So Sheikh Mahtawi, can you give us other details about his look, especially at the concept of Islamic unity and proximity between the religions?
Okay, as you mentioned, I think one of the great thing that he did was that to be ambassador of Ayatollah Burujerdi in order to extend the gratitude to Sheikh Shaltut for acknowledging Shia as one of the official Islamic sect. This is actually one of the important job that he did it along with Ayatollah Taleqani. They moved to Cairo and they met Sheikh Shaltut, the head of Al-Azhar at that time, and they extended the gratitude and the gratitude of Sayyid al-Burujerdi because of this acknowledgement. Besides this activity, we can see in Iran, since we have different denominations practicing their religion and denominations freely, in the west of Iran, in Kurdistan province, we have our Sunni brethren.
Yes.
So in order to get them united with the majority of the population of Iran who are Shia, he went there and he had a very fruitful and informative speech for them in order to clarify that three caliphs, although Shia do not consider them as the direct successors of the Prophet, but throughout the life of the Prophet, we cannot see any curse or any insult being addressed to these caliphs by the Prophet. That's why we, as the true followers of the Prophet, we are not allowed to curse or insult them.
Yes.
So it was the matter of bringing up the issue of unity in practice. You see, one outstanding Shia scholar is moving to a Sunni province, meaning the majority of the province are Sunnis, and he deliver such a speech on the issue of unity. Besides this activity, also we can mention his travel to Pakistan. He went to Pakistan also because of the invitation that he received from Pakistan, and he was trying to establish the issue of unity among the meeting and discussions that he had with their scholars, and also in Syria. As my brother mentioned, he was not only the man of speech, he was the man of action as well. He was the man of travel for the sake of implementing his intention, holy intention, which was unification and getting united all Muslim under one umbrella and around one table. So we see that even in Syria, in Damascus, he had a very nice meeting, fruitful meeting with the Sheikh Ahmed Koftaru, who was the actually great mufti. Who was leading the majority population of Syria.
That's right.
And also over there, he had a very fruitful speech on the issue of unity.
Yes.
So for such a scholar and such a fruitful life, I think the students of Hausa and Seminary School and those who have this intention of Gallery of Islam in general, they have to follow his footsteps in order to establish the unity among the Muslims in their hearts.
Yes.
Because we have one enemy, which is the Israel and actually arrogant powers, Israel and U.S.
Yes.
So in front of them, we must be united.
That's right. And as we said, his invitation to Islamic unity was based upon four important pillars: the very character of Prophet Muhammad, the Holy Quran, the Kaaba, and the leaders of the Muslim Ummah, namely the Aimmat al-Ma'sumin, with respect for, we can say, the Sunni caliphs, three important caliphs after Prophet Muhammad. And that's why he could, and he was successful in establishing dialogues between the Shias and, we can say, the Sunni brethren all around the world. A really fruitful life, although he had so many trips here and there, but he produced so many works. On the day of Ashura, he produced a very great book on the character of Imam Ali alayhi salam and Fatima al-Zahra, on Salman al-Farsi, you know, on Qiblatul Islam, and different, you know, aspects of the history of Islam. He produced outstanding works. 1363, according to the solar calendar, is the year that he passed away. His body was taken into the holy shrine of Hazrat al-Masuma and was buried in a chamber beside, we can say, the tomb of Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri. It is in the great courtyard of Hazrat al-Masuma. And different mourning ceremonies were held for him from the offices of Ayatollah Golpai Ghani and Ayatollah Mareshi al-Najafi. May Allah bless the soul of Mirza Khalil Kamarei, the man who dedicated his life for establishing Islamic unity among Muslims and Islamic denominations all across the world, inshallah. Thank you, Sheikh Mahdavi.
You're most welcome.
And Sheikh Ziya Inia.
Thank you, and you're most welcome.
For your presence in the program, The Teacher, and thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher, on the life of the late Ayatollah Haj Mirza Khalil Kamarei. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.